And welcome back once again to Battle Rattle Radio, brought to you by TACCOM Media. This is Triple D on the mic, and of course, the man behind the plan with one shepherd, Mr. Chris Larson.
Yeah, I've got to go wild. I know. So to say, we need to get some sound effects in there. We still need like some intro music. Dave, that's a shout out to you there, buddy. Anyway, we do, and we need some like sound effects and stuff. You always do that night. I want to do some kind of goofy thing.
Yeah, we do. I guess we could use a little promo. We'll get there. We will.
This is content.
That's content.
Format follows content.
That's right. Copy, as my professor used to say. All right. Well, let's see. Once you know, usually to start the show, we're going to talk a little bit about tonight. It's going to be a little more doctrine we're going to be covering on different types of operations and how they interact. But usually, take a few minutes to talk about what's going on in the leadership training community. And
that's a slow, underhanded pitch. Thank you. I'll take it. Yeah, no, actually, we do. Right after we post this, of course, this will come out in June 20th. But then over the 4th of July weekend, not on 4th of July itself, which I believe is a Monday, but on Saturday night, we have our Firefight TAC 8, which is kind of an ongoing thing we try to schedule each year. And, of course, July in Missouri is so incredibly hot, you might as well do a night off. And, of course, that's what this is. We have a infiltration clandestine link up, and it's just a lot of fun. It's a short lane, but, you know, it runs all night. And, of course, you know, you're there with miles and rifles and blanks and all that. So that's happening Saturday night over the Independence Day weekend. And then that's our 25-meter target. Our 300-meter target's really exciting, and I you know, I'm kind of hiding my lead here a little bit because we're still working out a lot of the details. But here's what it comes down to. We were approached, believe it or not, by the East Wind people who said, all right, Chris, it's time that One Shepherd does its own week-long event. You know, D-Day does theirs for paintball. East Wind does theirs for airsoft. Of course, Battle of the Bulge does theirs out in Pennsylvania each year for reenactors, World War II reenactors. And they said, it's time. It's time, you know, One Shepherd puts on a training and simulation event that's a week-long. And so that's what we're going to do. Again, that's our 300-meter target. This is being planned now. You have to plan these things a year ahead. So this is being planned for sometime in 2012, dates to be released at a different date. And names and everything else. Can't get too much into the particular, but I can tell you this, Triple D. Here was the game plan. The game plan was that one year, it follows something like our what we've done in the past with Insurgent Warfighter, but that was a three-day course. This will be the same thing, essentially, if you're on the Op 4, because it'll be a week-long course. But one year, it'll be Red Team Armies, and then the next year, the opposite year, the game plan is that it'll be Insurgent Warfighting. Now, if you're on the Blue 4, you also get variation, not just because you're aggressing against two different types of Op 4, but that very much changes the mission. You know, radically changes the mission and the scenario that you'll be in each year, too. So we're really looking forward to this. It's an enormous undertaking that's just in its infancy now, but that's where we are anyway.
Well, it sounds like it would provide a lot more, like, not just variety, but it's got to be a great training platform to have those changes coming at you if you're the Blue 4.
Well, you know, and that's one of the things. I mean, East Wind came and said, they flat out said it. I believe it or not, this was really instigated, though, of course, we've been thinking about this for years. They said, look, what One Shepherd brings that's unique to all those other entities I just mentioned is that we're a training entity. We are a leadership school. We teach tactics as our military model to teach leadership. And so they said, look, if anybody can do this and keep this fascinating and interesting and challenging, it's One Shepherd. Don't expect, you know, our clients will not expect to be in a week long of training. No, that's not what they do. They get about two and a half days of down and dirty, you know, really focused training. And the rest of the week is simulation to apply what you've just learned. And so we hope to keep it really exciting, really exhausting, but a lot of fun.
Yeah, I just can't imagine the exhaustion level. We could spend a whole show talking about that, just having done one of the 72-hour, you know, over 3-day events.
Right.
Wow, I feel like I've been gone a week.
Yeah. Now imagine doing it for a week. You feel like you're gone for 2 or 3 weeks.
Yeah, I could imagine easily. Well, we'll be looking forward. And, of course, we can get all the information on that through OD Journal and One Shepherd.
It will be announced later this year, probably not till the fall or late summer, to be honest, because we're still, you know, staff is still working on this before they can announce. You have to have a lot of the details worked out, not all of it. But you know that old 70% rule? You got to have about 70% of the plan before you say, okay, this is the plan. Otherwise, you wind up backpedaling too much.
All right, well, we can look through, and it'll overlap through both, either One Shepherd.
Oh, yeah. No, it'll be announced on both. You bet.
I'm sure we'll be covering some information on that probably here on Battle Rattle Radio, too.
I imagine you will, yeah.
Excellent. Well, we're looking forward to it. Let's get down to the nitty-gritty, though, if you like. Let's
sure.
Talk a little doctrine, a little bit of tactics. We were going to talk about different types of operations.
Right. Triple D called me a week ago and said, hey, I really want to talk about this, the topic of what's colloquially called decisive operations, shaping operations, enabling operations. And you have some motivation, and I'm sorry, I can't remember the exact, I don't want to put words in your mouth anyway, but you said your motivation, I mean, why is that so fascinating for you?
Well, I think the way to have seen it visually, and again, not to overplug, but at One Shepherd's Tactical, this was, 2 years ago, I want to think, when I was
right.
paired up with the Marines.
Last time you were in FTX, anyway.
Sure.
Yeah.
Just a fire team member, a fire team leader for the Marine Corps. They were the Blue Four.
Right.
Down there in north of Columbia there, which, by the way, is a fantastic event. But I think that's one of the things that sticks in my mind was seeing, you know, from an offensive position, particularly when we took over an offensive, because we had a rotation in that FTX.
Right.
Roughly about 18 hours or so, or 20 hours of offense, and then you switch over to defense. And
right.
That sounds short, but it's not.
No.
That's quite an effort. But anyway, really from the defensive standpoint, when we took over the offensive into the second stage, literally did nothing all night. Knew we were going to probably plan, even though it seems cliche, we knew we were going to plan an attack at dawn or close to. But literally all night, 8 hours, 9 hours straight, missions. More missions. We ran missions all night, different types of missions. And not just the ones that I was on, of course. One, you know, because you try to get some shot out here, come in and get a little time to sit. But you listen to, as the op four comes out, you get information even, you know, laterally about what other missions were accomplishing, what they were doing, what they ran into.
You know, you're actually getting to a big part of that. You want to talk about shaping and somewhat sustaining or enabling operations, and we'll get to where we're defining those. But what you're talking about is reconnaissance, or what's often called intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, ISR. And those ISR missions are exactly what you guys were doing just forever. And there's a lot to that. I mean, we say that reconnaissance is before, during, and after. It continues even after you've achieved your objective, because you have to know, you have to gain situational awareness. And the question after is, how is the enemy reacting to this? And so people don't get a grasp on that. And if you look at your rules for managing ISR assets, reconnaissance assets, one of the rules is always assign an objective. You don't just say go out and do reconnaissance. You have to have named areas of interest or targeted areas of interest and say specifically, I want to know what's there. I want to know what's not there. I want to know what's in between us and there. How easy is it to get there? How easy is it not to get there? So there's route reconnaissance, you know, area reconnaissance, zone reconnaissance, reconnaissance in force. Probe the enemy once you find them, shoot, see what their weapon systems, what capabilities they have, and where they are. So there's all these things going on, and as you know, all those missions were being run that night, that evening, all night long, and you're gaining that information. The other rule, one of the other, cardinal rules of managing reconnaissance or ISR assets is don't hold it in reserve. Look, you want a reserve. There's no question about that. But ISR are basically your eyes and ears. How often do we drive around the city closing one eye and plugging one ear up? You don't hold that stuff in reserve, or you don't gain situational awareness. And so, yeah, what you were on and what you saw transpiring there was phenomenal. It was a very effective management of the ISR. And, of course, it paid dividends. I remember that Sunday morning attack you guys did. It really paid dividends.
Oh, you know, it's funny. You think about the time frame that you, and all the preparation, all the missions, and all the energy that you put into that for, like, it turned out to be a very well, not to get our own horns, but it was a very well planned assault, very effective. We overpowered a lot of their holes. And
how long did it last? I mean, from the first shot to the last shot, what, maybe 6-8 minutes, maybe?
I think that's a stretch, yeah.
Yeah, it probably is. Probably shorter than
that. It was very effective, very quick, and I thought, wow, we ran missions and lost out on sleep. And, you know, I went on so many missions, and so much for hours, yeah. For a 6 minute at best. Which was, you know, probably ideal that it was that quick. But you know, getting back to the meat of it, though, really, I mean, what we're talking about. So all those missions, all that intelligence gathering, all that, those are shaping missions, right?
Yeah, those are shaping operations. Shaping operations, in its easiest definition, or way to remember it anyway, is that shaping operations shape the conditions for success. Shaping operations are not the main effort. The main effort is decisive operations, and we'll talk about that in a second, what it means to be decisive or decisively engaged. But shaping operations shape the conditions. And of course, reconnaissance does this before, during, and after. But you know, you have other shaping operations. You have an enveloping force. Let's say your main force is going to hit the enemy. So that you intentionally, you want to knock, you know you can't get them all, they're big. You're not going to do that. You're going to knock them off keel and send them packing. So what you've done then is you've looked at where are their escape routes? Where are their routes of egress, lines of egress? And what you're doing then is, it's a weird name, lines of communication, but it means their supply lines, their lock lines of communication. And so you find those with reconnaissance, and then you move blocking elements very, very discreetly. Now, you have to do this discreetly, but you move blocking elements to envelop those lines of communication in the enemy's rear. This way, when you hit them in the front with that attack, they will retreat. If they know your forces behind them, they're not going to retreat. They're going to stay in their fighting positions and die and fight to the last man, and you're going to have a bloody, bloody battle. It's going to cost you. It's going to cost them. It's far more carnage than you need. So what happens is you have to do these envelopments. There's double envelopments, you know, the pincer movement. There's a single envelopment. There's a vertical envelopment with airborne or air assault troops, glider infantry back if you're World War II. That's a vertical envelopment, and you got to get that into the enemy's rear. And then hit them and knock them off. But those are examples of, you know, reconnaissance and enveloping forces. These are examples of shaping operations. There's other engineers come in and they may clear a minefield. Or engineers may establish a floating bridge so that you can get across the river. Those are shaping operations for success. You know, I don't know what else to say about that. I mean, there's so much to say about that. But yeah, I mean, these are usually, not always, but usually you have combat arms branches, you know, combat engineers, armor, other infantry, you know, air cavalry and stuff like this. These guys are out moving around and stuff like that. Those are usually...
They're doing shaping missions.
Yeah.
Assistance.
Now, I think what you got to remember here is that you say shaping, right? And to you and I, if you look at the bigger picture, you'll see, oh man, that's a shaping operation because this team's got an envelopment, you know? Oh, they've got a vertical envelopment. And look at these engineers over here. They've got to clear that minefield so the main attack can get through. Well, let me tell you, that's true in a big perspective, but no commander, and I can promise you this, no commander believes that they have a shaping operation. Because their piece of the pie, their piece of the bigger puzzle, you see, their senior higher command may say, yeah, that's a shaping operation to clear that minefield. But I can guarantee you that engineer commander and all of his subordinate commanders believe we have the most critical piece. We are assigned to a necessary objective. And then, of course, he gives his that commander, that engineer commander, gives his commander's intent, and as, of course, you know that, we've talked about this way too many times, it's nested within the higher chain of command, commander's intent, mm-hmm. but that commander's intent looks very, very different, and it says, clearing this minefield is the decisive operation, is the main effort.
It's exclusive to each commander at that level.
It's nested, yeah. And every time, you whatever your piece of the pie is, now, if your piece of the pie is, Drew, you're going to go on a vertical, you're going to take troops and you're going to go on a vertical envelopment, then you sit there, Triple D, and you say, oh, well, then getting my troops there into the enemy's lines of communication discreetly and quickly and with enough power to crush the enemy as they become disarrayed and try to escape, that's the decisive operation for me. And it is, and it should be. But again, for the larger operation, that's a shaping operation. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's like a cycle that never ends. Like, say, for example, the commander of the combat engineers is going to go and clear that minefield. That's his decisive action for his unit. He puts together, obviously they build an op four, but he creates his commander's intent out of that. But what's funny is his decisive action will probably have some shaping missions.
You're right. You got it exactly. It is tiered like that. And let's clear this up. Decisive operations. It's easier to say decisively engaged. And what it means to be decisively engaged means that you have locked horns with an opponent. And at this point, one of you is going to win and one of you is going to lose. And so when you think about this combat engineer commander who's got a shaping operation to clear the minefields, probably protected by enemy fire, direct or indirect, and he's going to turn and say to his troops, all right, this is our mission. You can see he will be decisively engaged at some point. We can anticipate that. And so you're absolutely right. He's going to say, all right, this platoon, you know, has the decisive operation to clear the mines, but I'm going to give this platoon a shaping operation called security. And overwatch. You see? And then another platoon is going to have sustaining operations to feed those two efforts. If nothing else, just as replacements. You got it?
No, I do have it. I'm getting it. And the idea of it being tiered down like that at multiple levels, that can go down quite a ways, that tiering.
Oh, yeah. In fact, I think it does. I think it does for each command. If a brigade, this is a brigade operation, then each of the battalion commanders, the maneuver battalions, such as infantry and armor and tanks, you know, they are assigned decisive or shaping operations. Your special troops battalion commander, which has a lot of the combat service and support, is going to be assigned, you know, either shaping or enabling operations, because enabling operations, of course, sustain both the shaping and decisive operations. And so, yeah, you know, all these people are going to be assigned to something, but I don't care if you're in a sustaining, enabling operations as sustainment. Hey, look, troop transport in vehicles. So you've got these up-armored, you know, 5-ton vehicles that are supposed to run 18 troops into the battle at a time. If those things break down, then you see what I'm saying? Then the whole system breaks down. So for you, that's very, very decisive. We must keep these vehicles moving back and forth. We must keep the routes clear. What if the routes get littered with damaged vehicles? What if the routes get littered with wounded coming back in? You see what I'm saying? You're going, oh, I didn't even think about that. Well, this is what happened at Verdun. They had this great plan in World War I to shove the British troops forward, but they didn't believe in sustaining operations at that point, so the first mistake is they made every troop carry their entire kit, not just their battle rattle, but rucksacks and an incredible amount of weight. And, of course, the Germans were just machine-gunning them down because these guys couldn't maneuver, they couldn't run. And they're just dying in mass and being wounded. Well, these casualties are being pulled from the battlefield by the medical corps, and that clogged the trenches. They're trying to pull them back. And now infantry and all these combat arms guys couldn't get to the front to get into their decisive operations, which was the main attack. And so the main attack was thin. And this carnage went on for days. Well, see, this is the sort of thing. So you say, oh, well, if you're back there doing casualty, you know, collection, you're not in a decisive operation. Well, no. For the bigger picture, you're not. You're in a enabling operation. You're a sustaining operation. That is enabling, sustaining the success. But if you do it poorly, if you have a poor plan, then your vehicles run out of gas. Your wounded and your burnt-out vehicles are clogging the route forward. So you very much want that transportation commander to believe this is the decisive thing that keeps the force rolling forward. Absolutely.
It makes great sense. Now, and you were switching over, you're talking, and that's what my next question was going to be, and you already started to answer it, so to speak, but on the enabling. So just by mentioning specifics, transportation, that's enabling.
Mm-hmm. Communications, enabling.
Food,
yes. You got to keep. You know how many battles have been lost or at least not capitalized on because troops ran out of water? Yeah. You've got to keep all the bees, we say, beans, bullets, and batteries. Beans, bullets, and Band-Aids. You know, I mean, all of those. There's just, yeah, you've got to keep that, you've got to keep those logistical supplies coming forward. You know another one? Your S1 officer, your S1 personnel officer is getting replacements and sending them forward. So over a long period of time, casualty replacements. You know, and it may not be necessarily casualty replacements like ones and twos and ten at a time, but it might be, oh, this rifle company is exhausted. Well, let's do a passage of line so a fresh rifle company can pass through that rifle company. Very, very dangerous thing to do. And then take the lead on this attack. So, passage of lines. Well, again, the S1 and the S4, the S1 personnel officer, the S4 logistics officer, the S2 intelligence officer and the S3 operations officer all need to be involved in that, and it's very much a sustaining operation. It's an enabling operation. Yeah, fuel. There's another enabling operation. So we've said what? You know, your classification supplies, you know, you've got fuel and water and munitions and meals and all of these things. Plus you've got communication is an enabling operation. You've got transportation as an enabling operation. You've got casualty collection and frankly, quartermaster has to take care of the dead. So you've got all of these things going on. Well, yeah, right. Munitions, ammunitions, you know, all of this.
Well, that's enabling. You know, it's interesting when you think, like, how you know, that approach, though. Like, for example, a commander that's involved. Obviously, any commander that's got some sort of, knows what they're doing is going to recognize that their mission, while they're going to treat it decisively, is usually going to, they're going to recognize that it's enabling. I'm making sure that the munitions are to these units where they need to be.
Sure, but I think the mistake, you're absolutely right. He's going to realize that's an enabling operation. Absolutely. But what I think we forget is we say, oh, well, that's not kinetic. Come on, you're carrying or driving, you know, truckloads of ammunition. Right, and since you're either carrying it or driving it, you now probably have route security and convoy operations security. So you can get into the kinetic, that is, the violent operations, that is, trading shots with the enemy.
Sure, that's just what I was getting ready to ask. I mean, you think about just the specifics of getting the logistics, getting those things done. There's no guarantee that, like you're mentioning, wounded clogging a road. Well, how do we know it's not going to be the enemy?
Right.
You know, for example, which is, you know, I've read some, actually seen some great documentaries on some transportation units, actually, that in World War II and some of the things that occurred to them. And the story does get aggressive.
Well, you know, even when the enemy can't get armored columns or infantry back into, you know, the good guys' rear area to stop up lines of communication and supply and logistics, even when they can't do that, you know what they can do? They can shoot artillery. They can do strafing runs from, you know, jet fighters. So they can do one kind of bombardment, indirect fires now, instead of direct fires. They can do one kind of bombardment or another. And if they can't do any of those, they can't do air, you know, air support. They have no, you know, sustaining or you know, supporting artillery, and they haven't been successful in, you know, in breaching the friendly line in large numbers. They can always infiltrate small teams to set mines and IEDs. So you're trying to, what the enemy's trying to do is disrupt our logistics, disrupt our enabling operations. And guess what? We're trying to do that to them too.
So it makes sense that aggressive action in those enabling operations is essentially somewhat inevitable.
Well, yeah, you're a target. You are a target. You're a very viable target.
So that would be where the mistake is made, right? Like you're
yeah,
saying.
Sure. I mean, you know, look, when I was I hate to admit this. I am embarrassed to say this, but it's, you know, level of maturity, right? When I was a young infantryman, you know, 19, 20 years old and stuff, before I'd gotten off to really see the rest of the Army through, you know, NCO academies and all this stuff, you're sequestered, or is that the right word, like the nuns?
It's narrowed down, yes.
Yeah, right. Okay, so you're just with infantry. And even though I'd already been to a combat theater at that point, I'd been so much just with infantry that my opinion was, if you aren't infantry, you're not really in the Army. Well, I got a rude awakening about that. And I think there's a lot of, I think that's very common when you're so young and so inexperienced, that you really do believe that whatever you're doing is the decisive thing for the entire Army, right? Okay, so I thought that, and the more I worked with, both in schools and institutions and frankly through the day-to-day work, you know, you start working with these rear echelon guys and you start seeing what they're doing, and you start having, as you get up in leadership, you have to coordinate for those kind of supplies and everything, and you start saying, oh my gosh, we're not going anywhere unless the fuel gets here, unless the birds arrive. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, absolutely. That's crippling.
Yeah.
Everything stops, literally.
Yeah. No, you learn real quick. Probably not quick enough, but you learn real quick not to be so elitist about this. And you also learn real quick that those rear echelon guys are very much in the fight. And boy, has that been true in Afghanistan and Iraq, where we're in counterinsurgency. But even when you are in, you know, full kinetic operations, full invasion, you know, violent operations, you still find, oh my gosh, you know, they're not, the rear echelon guys, those enabling, you know, combat service support that are doing the enabling operations, they're on the casualty list too. You know, they're getting hit by the enemy also. And so, you know, enough of that. We're all green. We all, you know, have, you know, red, white, and blue blood. So, you know.
Well, I think, like you said, you get to a command, you learn more about the military, and you get to an NCO standpoint, which obviously branches out your horizons, and you realize, okay, it's right there in front of your face. This isn't going to happen if this supply and this stuff isn't there. If the ordnance isn't there, we're just not going to make it.
Right. Now, and so I don't think you can underemphasize that. In fact, you wind up being tasked to that. You know, I talked about route security and convoy security and all those. It's not uncommon for infantry to be tasked, of course, or combat arms branches to that sort of thing, so that we can get these supplies through.
Yeah, the security might be provided by another unit, or there might be armor running up those roads, escorting things like that.
No doubt about it. Yeah, you know, gun trucks and everything else. No doubt about it. And that's why. So you start seeing that, and you start realizing, wait, the world does not evolve, you know, revolve around me, you know. So, too bad, it should, but it doesn't. Now, having said all that, you know, Triple D, let's not lose sight of something. Decisively engage is decisively engaged, so we have our decisive operations. Let's not get lost, let's not lose the force through the trees. When you're setting up a mission, when you're planning a mission, I don't care if you're planning it for a squad or you're planning it for a brigade, you know, 3,500 troops or 9 troops, doesn't make any difference. You need to know. You need to be able to say, this is the singular most important thing. You know, when you're coming up with your commander's intent, but you really need to intuitively understand that. Look at the situation and measure that and say, this is the most important thing for success. We will not succeed until this is achieved. Now, you have to be able to do that. And there's, for many, many good reasons. But the main effort comes into, what plays in here is one of the nine principles of war. This gets into Clausewitzian, military philosophy. But it's called economy of force. And I think, not to be condescending, but I'm surprised how many people don't discuss economy of force. And I don't know if it's because it's they understand it so intuitively or they're just lost on what does that mean. But economy of force boils down to this. It means figure out what's the single most important variable, the single most important objective, okay, and appropriate enough combat power to get that done. Be very, very greedy with your combat power, and in fact, all your resources. Be very greedy with sending them to shaping operations and sending those that combat power and those resources to enabling operations. Do you have to do it? Yes. But be greedy. Be guarded. Because you have to keep the greatest number and the greatest resources focused on that one single thing.
And that's where the decisive comes into play.
That's the decisive operation. And that whole concept is called economy of force. So, you do have to do that. You know, I just thought, I don't know why I was thinking that, but you know, if you're doing a frontal attack, the enemy better not know where it is, right? One of the things we often do is a feign attack. It's a fake. It's a feign, you know? You see that in football all the time. So that means I have to cut off honest-to-God resources and say, all right, there's a shaping operation. The shaping operation, and it is, it's shaping, because even though it's not a real attack, it will convince the enemy it's a real attack, and the enemy will dispatch the reserves, and their focus will go over to that feign, where the real attack will then catch the enemy by surprise at a place they didn't expect it. Look at Normandy. We went into Normandy, right? And I'm drawing a blank. Where were they?
Calais.
They were dropping all the little paratroopers. But the point is, they still, even those were just fireworks and little, like, 2-foot paratrooper dolls, the point is, they still had to send aircraft, badly needed aircraft, to Calais.
The pilots to fly them. The fuel that was used.
The supporting fighters to protect them. And convince the enemy this is real. So a feign attack is a shaping operation. Again, it's shaping the success for the decisive operation. But it sucks up resources from your enabling operations. Once again, enabling and shaping operations are absolutely vital to success. But due to economy of force, or the economy of force insists, we have to be greedy about protecting those resources and applying them as needed, as appropriate to the decisive operation.
Well, that's a fine line.
Yeah.
That's the first thing that comes to mind when you mention that. I mean, because you have to, the feint attack, for example, you have to almost use the economy of force with that as well. You have to know that you're committing while you're still being stingy. You can't half-step it. It has to be convinced the enemy. It has to have... Or if it's not a feign attack, if you're going to do, you don't send one man out on a one-man recon by fire.
Right.
You have to commit at least the bare minimum that's going to take, at least, to get that done. You know, as much as you want to hold on to your resources for decisive action, it's a fine line. You can't.
And you see that. People say, oh, I want to husband these resources. I want to keep them tight. And that's what I said. We have a tendency to do that. As commanders, and then we do silly things like, oh, I want to husband my resources and save my fuel and keep everybody rested and ready to go, and oh, by the way, I'm no longer sending out things like reconnaissance. You see what's going on there?
Yes.
There's so much...
Awareness is already being compromised at that point.
Right. I mean, it's such a paradox. There are competing demands on that commander and that staff and that those decisions. There are so many competing demands, and it's a real balancing act between the three: decisive operations, shaping operations, enabling operations.
Getting one of the three wrong can be costly.
Well, it can, because even if you Even if you enjoy initial success, you see this time and time again in places like World War One or the border with war with Iran and Iraq. You see they have some initial success. In fact, you know, very clearly enjoy success. But they didn't allocate enough resources to enabling operations or shaping operations or whatever the case was. They lose momentum. They lose momentum quickly. They culminate quick because they exhaust. They exhaust either in time in terms of they become tired, fatigued, or they exhaust their fuel, or they exhaust their water and rations and ammunition. You see what I'm saying? They exhaust themselves, or frankly, they just become too thin of a force and too fall prey to counterattack. So they reach culmination quickly if you cannot balance these.
You know, it'd be an interesting study to look and see how often getting this formula you're talking about, this balancing act, wrong was the reason for military defeat, as opposed to how many times it was literally the winning tactics of the other side. You see what I'm saying? I
mean, right.
Was it really that decisive of a victory for the opposing team, or was it, you really misallocating these things?
And historians look at this and tacticians and strategists, and they look at, mission after mission, and I think there's always going to be an element of both. You're right. Every time two opponents meet, it doesn't matter whether it's America or not. I mean, we can be talking about the Greek army, back in Alexander's day, right? When two opponents meet, there's always an element of, well, one side just had the better tactics. But that's too, linear. It's not. It doesn't have enough depth. The answer is one side had a careful balance of decisive, or at least a better balance of decisive shaping and enabling operations, and the other side didn't have a good enough balance. It doesn't matter whether you're on the defense or the offense.
The same concepts apply. It's just a matter of whether you allocated your resources.
Well, there's just so many times where you, in history, though I admit it's rare and that's why it's fascinating, but we look where a vastly outnumbered force fights off, and a force it shouldn't be able to fight off. And you say, well, it was physical positioning on the battles in the battle space. They had the high ground, or they had the better terrain, or they had better this or that or the other thing. Okay, that's obviously an element in it. Well, they had better leadership and better training, you see, and better communication, and so that's an element of it. Or they had better technology. Well, that's an element of it. But we can then again look at another one and say, another example in history, and there's no sense in sitting here pulling them out. There are just so many that exist where we say, well, then, if that's all true, how come this group, with worse terrain, worse leadership and training, and worse technology, won? How is it that the American forces were booted out of Somalia? How is it that Rhodesia was lost by a bunch of barefooted guerrillas to a vastly superior force?
Well, you can look at the Civil War, the first 2 years of the American Civil War, and you'll see exactly the same thing. Total misallocation of resources.
Right.
Northern Army was bigger, more munitions, way better support.
Often better trained.
But certain leaders just didn't. Boy, like you said, they were stingy with the resources over and over.
McClellan.
Again.
McClellan is a perfect case of that. A lot of military historians can't stand him. Now he has his fans, and he has his apologists. But that man suffered from the term. What is it? Pusillanimous. Pusillanimous. Boy, that's a good word to know. It's exactly the opposite of what we want our military men and women to be. It means suffering from such a effete disposition, being indecisive. That really does describe McClellan very well.
Very
he had
good.
The upper hand in every measure and would not go on the offensive.
So what was really happening there was, while he may have been somewhat committed to his decisive operations, he didn't allocate his resources enough.
Right.
Or he did, actually, many times he did lots of shaping missions and didn't do anything decisive.
That's right. He maneuvered. He seemed to keep good enabling operations. He did lots of shaping operations. He wouldn't decisively engage.
And Lee knew it, too. It's funny. It's interesting. That's what I was bringing up just a few minutes ago. The concept that, like, here's a great... Obviously, Robert E. Lee was a great military leader.
Sure,
his doctrine went well into the 20th century, early 20th century. But, you know, at the same time, he was someone who was able to realize that my enemy is misappropriating stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe he's aware of what's going on, but he's not willing to do anything about it. And I've learned that through fighting with the gentleman, so you know, and meeting his tactics, or if it was somebody else in another environment where they say, "Hey, this enemy is very aggressive. They're very decisive, but I don't know. They're so far away from anywhere. I know they're going to be able to get fuel. So that tells me their enabling missions are weak. This commander has not allocated, and then you can take advantage of that."
Right.
So a lot of times that, you know, referring to like military conflicts, like you said, there's going to be a winner and there's going to be a loser and there's going to be tactics, you know, as going to be one of the key factors in that, obviously. But
sure.
At the same time, realizing this, how my opponent's commander, the commander of the opposing army, how they're allocating their resources as far as decisive, enabling, and shaping operations tells a story.
No, you're absolutely right. And there's lots of course, you know, in any conflict, there's lots of good examples to look at, but if you want to look at during that same conflict, if you want to talk about someone who does wonderful balance of decisive shaping and enabling operations, you'd have to look at Sherman's march through the South, where he sets off pretty much on his own with a large force, but nonetheless manages to. I mean, think about the enabling and the shaping alone. But when he finally does meet, you know, the few times and a few cities he does attack, the port that they're in, it's in Georgia that he takes, he does it very decisively. There's no half step. It's, in fact, often the violence is so quick it saves lives because it's very clear who's the victor and the enemy surrender. So... No.
Yeah, really far removed from like what March to the Sea you're referring to,
right.
Through Georgia.
Wow. Right.
That's about as south as it gets.
Right, March to the Sea, and then, of course, he was resupplied there, but then March, remember, he marches all the way up through South Carolina, North Carolina, and on into Virginia. So, I mean, just a phenomenal undertaking by today's standard. And he did it more than 150 years ago.
Again, but he wouldn't be able to do it without the proper balance between those three.
No, he seemed to really, you know, you have to give that to Sherman. He really seems to, like I said, balance well. He seemed to, I don't know if he, well, I say it's intuitive. No, he was a studied man. I think he learned it, and he learned it right.
Well, he's a West Point graduate.
Right.
So, well, it's interesting. You know, there's so many things that we talk about on this show. And again, you know, to get back to that question you asked me earlier on why I was so, you know, interested in operations and wanted to do a show on operations and why I'm fascinated with it. It's when you see it firsthand, you know, and you're able to get involved and see these different elements working together. And I think it becomes really special when you're able to pair that up with the chain of command.
Oh,
who's
yeah.
responsible for commander's intent? Who's responsible for making sure these operations, these shaping operations are going on, you know? And then you take it up to a grander scale where, like you mentioned, where you've got entire divisions, or units, rather, that are providing the enabling operation for another unit. And those units can both be really darn big.
Yeah, oh, sure. I mean,
huge.
Look at, you know, things like Normandy and, the first Gulf War, the OIF, the first push in. I mean, we are talking hundreds of thousands of people. So, you know, an army division is somewhere between 12 and 15,000 in general. And it's got, plus it's got attachments to that. But if you see the 101st, the 10th Mountain, the 82nd, the 25th, the 3rd, the 4th, the 10th, you know, whatever, these divisions, they all tend to be about 12 to 15,000 troops. So if you're talking, you know, the west flank of Desert Storm.
Oh, we had 600,000 American troops.
Well, you've got 75,000 troops just on the west flank alone. So you're saying, oh my goodness, Oh my goodness. What is that? Five divisions?
Five divisions.
Yeah. Yeah, the French were over there. The Americans were over there. I think the Syrians, I think, were over there. The Egyptians. I mean, it was just enormous.
Canadians.
Yeah.
Australians.
Yeah.
Huge.
Yeah.
It's funny to see. But again, this, what we were talking about, this formula doesn't change.
No. It's scalable. It's scalable again. And don't get me wrong. You know, a squad can only, you know, whether you're a Marine squad with three fire teams, of course, and you saw that. I really like that, by the way. I keep asking the Marines, how do you all fit in one vehicle? And they say, we don't. I said, well, that's an interesting solution to it. Each squad gets two vehicles. But anyway, that's why the Army is stuck on two fire teams, is because they can, with two fire teams and a squad leader, they can get everybody into a single vehicle. But anyway, so whether you have two fire teams or whether you have three fire teams, you know, there's only so much you can do, but the principles are still there. You still set a base of fire. You still set a flanking or an enveloping force, you know, on an attack. You still have to breach the enemy's outer perimeter, and then someone has to go in and exploit that. So the breach is a shaping operation. The exploiting fire team is the decisive, getting right in there and mixing it up with the enemy right at their fighting positions. And then somehow this has got to be sustained. So, you know, the squad may be doing it, but you're getting sustained from the, you know, from your platoon, from your company, from your battalion.
Now, how would indirect fire, friendly indirect fire, is that sustaining? How does that work? If it's done in support of an assault, like, well, usually
fires like that are considered shaping, because they're intended to have a specific effect on the enemy. Disrupt them, block them, trap them, destroy them, whatever, you know, at a certain locale. So indirect fires like close air support and artillery or mortars are usually shaping operations. But I'm not going to say they can't be sustaining. I'd still tend to think of them,
towards,
yeah, shaping, and that sustaining or enabling operations then sustain those shaping operations. That makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, you know, it's been said for a century now. You can bomb from the air, but eventually you got to put infantry on the ground.
Sure.
That's because air bombardment is a shaping operation, not a decisive operation.
Well, it makes sense. I mean, I suppose, like, you know, when you think about it, that gets, those lines get a little hazy for me in ways. But I mean,
sure they do.
When you think about during, you know, the B-17 bombers that were flying over Germany and things of that nature, like, taking off from England, obviously rear echelon. You know, I mean, they were enjoying the nightlife and enjoying the day, you know, in England.
Well, I see what you're saying. You're right. They're positioned, and I would call them frontline troops, but bombers and fighters. But I see what you're saying. Yes, they are. Their position is in the rear. They are in the rear echelon, very, very much in the rear. There's no question about that. Of course, but then they come up to the front lines.
Yes, absolutely.
And are exposed to great danger. You know, very, very austere conditions. Though for fleeting moments at a time, right? But then you're right. I mean, here's a point where you go, okay, if the bombing of this area is a shaping operation, then what are the fighter aircraft that shoot down the enemy fighter aircraft to save the bombers? Aren't they decisive? You know, or is that also shaping? And you know, it's a good question. If you ask the Air Force, what are they going to tell you?
Decisive.
Well, those are decisive.
Oh,
right, sure.
Fairly decisive. I think sometimes, you know, when you were talking early in, during that campaign, that there weren't any Allied forces in Europe, so to speak.
Right.
So they weren't really going to support troops on the ground. So maybe those were just single bombing missions.
Sure. Back then, you know, you're getting into, you know, total war, right, where we could bomb factories and everything else. Now that's, you can get away with at some level, as we're seeing in Tripoli and you know, in Libya, where they are bombing resources deep in the enemy's rear, you know, fuel depots and stuff like this. But you're getting farther and farther away from that. You know, that is, we got to be so careful about doing that these days, and probably rightfully so. You know, why make enemies? Do what you got to do, but don't unnecessarily kill anybody, and of course, non-combatants are, you know, even more so, we have to be careful about that. Nonetheless, you're right.
Well, even if there's a time delay, though, those are shaping missions. If you were to go, sure. I mean, they are, because eventually you believe that you're going to have, you're obviously bombing those targets for a reason. You're going to have troops in that area, or there's
that's right.
objectives. So even if they're way ahead, 2 weeks ahead of time, you start bombing.
It was argued strategic bombing, you know, was argued it was months and even years ahead. You're denying the enemy resources by bombing their factories, their fuel depots, you know, their shipping yards.
You brought up the Gulf War. I mean, the air war started, and it was a good 45 days, I want to say, before ground troops really.
I forget what it is, but it's about a month anyway.
It was something like that, 35 days. And then they. Now, there was obviously some, you know, special operations going on. You know, that's, you know, it's interesting to.
And of course, special operations will tell you what. Well, we're all decisive.
Yeah, everybody has a. That's part of that camaraderie. But even the infantry will. You know, you talk to guys that were 11 Bravo, and then you see one of them that's 82nd. They're going to talk down the 11 Bravo all year. You know, you're just.
That's right. You're a leg. I'm airborne.
Yeah, that never ends. You're not going to get away with that. You know, it's funny. I'm sure you've probably seen on the History Channel, but they actually cover the B-17 bombers, the history of them.
Oh, sure.
And the one, it was actually an interview. This is an older gentleman who actually been there. It was one of the interviews he was talking about. He ran into military troop, the army, you know, infantry, and they were, of course, that talking smack going on. He was like, "You fly boys, you know," and all this other stuff. And he's like, "Hey, I'll trade you." And he's like, "Okay, well, what do you do?" He's like, "I'm the ball turret gunner." And he's like, "You go to hell." That's his response. He's like, because of, well, obviously, I'm sure you're aware of the statistics on the life expectancy of the ball turret guy. But I thought it was a really funny story where you see that comrade was like, "Oh, I'll do your job." He's like, "Oh, really? Okay, we'll trade." He's like, "What do you do?" "I'm the ball turret gunner." "Oh, no, that's okay." On second thought.
No, you're right. I mean, you know, I believe you've heard me say this way too much, Triple D, and I believe being elite is indeed a good thing, and it is an honorable pursuit. I don't care what you do, as one old first sergeant used to tell me. I don't care what you do. Do it the best. So the pursuit of being elite and the state of being elite are indeed good things. Elitism is caustic. It's deteriorative. It degrades morale. It degrades communication between, you know, units, and that's critical. We've seen where this has failed time and time again in history. So, I don't like elitism. Now, I like making fun of people, you know, there's just elbowing and ribbing each other. Hey, that's fair game. That's good stuff. Yeah, right,
sure.
right. So as long as we understand we're all on the same side and everybody's contribution is in earnest, you know, then we're good. Yeah.
Without a doubt. Well, so, you know, we bounced around a lot, but once again, sticking with in this framework of operations. And, you know, it's funny how you can use these and you can look and you're breaking these things down, like, and it can bring up subjects like different troops, you know, different units and stuff like that. All of that sort of in a weird sort of way fits within the framework of what we're talking about.
Sure. Sure. Yeah. Sure it does. Yeah. I mean, and of course, like I said, it applies. Decisive operations, shaping operations, enabling operations applies to you. I don't care what kind of job you have in the military. That applies. I don't care what, you know, what level of unit you're in. Are you in a platoon? Or, and again, a brigade, a division, a corps? You know,
fire team.
Yeah. You're right. You're part of these considerations. Absolutely you are.
I think it's great to have these as a resource. I think this show and the shows we've been doing regarding, you know, because we like to get specific, like you said, we like to talk about the things that are sexy.
Right.
This doctrine, it's residual, you know, and it'd be a great resource to go back and listen to for.
No, you're absolutely right. And when you drill down, as you're saying, look, you can drill down to smaller units, you can drill down to smaller tasks. But you're still, you know, if you've got this as a framework, these three types of operations, decisive, shaping, enabling, if you've got that as your framework, it helps you understand how not only how you bridge to other units adjacent to you, but also how you bridge to higher commands. And so, no, you're right. It's a wonderful framework to have.
You know, it's difficult to really look at one little aspect of the military and all of it, because it's encompassing, but it's difficult to really look at it and say, okay, well, this is how it works. But this is close.
Right.
This is very close to being able to go, okay, this is how this works.
Well, now you're getting me to say it, and I've probably already said it too many times, but, you know, all models are lies. That's why I love models. It allows me to lie to people all day long, because we all agree, well, that's a model. And, you know, you're right. You can think of decisive shaping enabling operations as a model and say, man, that's really very representative of the truth. I mean, it's not the truth, but it's very representative of it. So...
Yeah. Well, like you said, how long does a plan last?
Yeah, so, until someone shoots at you.
Right,
I think.
And then, yeah. then it's kind of all ad lib from there.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah.
Well, I had a good time doing the show, Chris. Once again, it's always a great time to get on here and talk a little bit about this stuff. Did you have anything? You've covered the schedule. I think we know what's happening. And
right. No, we're good. And I had a good time, too. I'm glad you came up with this. I mean, it's, like I said, great framework stuff. And so it allows us to drill down deeper into, you know, the sexy stuff. But this is fun.
I enjoy it. So we'll be signing out here, and we'll be talking to you again soon here on Battle Rattle Radio, part of TACCOM Media. And Chris, say goodnight.
Goodnight, Chris.
This is Triple D signing out. We'll see you next time.